Good evening, everybody. This is the Judicial Call. I'm Representative Mark Binder, filling in. We have a teaching tonight from Texas County Judge Daniel Weirman, and he's going to finish the third part of his teaching from JFK to the Future. And I'll get us started with a prayer, and then we'll turn it over to Daniel. Thou there, Creator, in the name of Yeshua, and by your request, through the prophets, Father, and by the calling that your word tells us to step into as kings and priests on the order of Melchizedek, and to shout our enemies down like at Jericho, we praise and thank you, Father, that every evil ruler and every person in these powerful positions will be removed. We also decree and declare that no weapon formed against us shall prosper, and we shout down our enemies as you have told us to do. And that no weapon formed against us shall prosper, and that our evil enemies shall not prevail and shall be removed, and that every lie will be revealed, and that the truth shall destroy every lie, every hold, every bondage that is against us and has been holding us hostage. And we decree and declare that there will be a great shaking that will wake up the people, will wake up the church, will wake up the people to our rightful government, and it will shake us loose from all this babble and confusion of the world. And we decree and declare that we will stand fast and focus on you and your word, Father, no matter how bad the enemy tells us it is, for the enemy is a liar. We decree and declare that just like the walls of Jericho, they will all come crashing down and made null and void. And we decree and declare that all your children shall be compensated, and all innocent people being unlawfully detained as well shall be returned to their families with full restitution in the name of Yeshua. We further pray for nation, our military, our true presidents, our children, a republic that proclaims that the law that your word gives us to be governed by, the law of nature and nature's God. So strengthen us by your healing power, guide us by your word, protect us with the gospel armor and dome of angelic protection all around us. But you are God, and there is no other. We pray according to your will, your word, and your plan, Father. God save the Republic, in Yeshua's name. Thank you, Father. Amen. It's all yours, Daniel.
All right. Good evening, everybody. I am, as Mark mentioned, I am D.W. Weirman, Daniel, Nan. I go by D.W., but I am a county justice for Bell County in the great state of Texas. And what I've been doing pretty much over the last month and a half, roughly, is doing these teachings. The first one that I did was actually with slides and everything on there, and actually had some visuals. So one of the challenges on some of these things of doing this just in a verbal sense is you lose that visual piece of it. And so there's going to be a lot of things tonight that I'm going to kind of ask for you to try to bring an image into your mind so that it will kind of sink a little bit deeper and you're able to hold on to it within your mind. And it brings a little more clarity to it. But for some of y'all that don't know who I am, as I mentioned, I am a interim county justice for Bell County with the Republic. I'm also a retired U.S. Army Chief Warrant Officer for Intelligence Analysis and an ordained minister. I will do my best not to get up on a soapbox with it being Sunday. But the Lord has brought me through different stages in my life and has set me up in training for many different things throughout my life. And one of the things is to actually take so much information, break it down into the farthest bits that I can get them broken down to, analyze them, put them back together in a understandable fashion that everybody is able to understand at multiple levels. So that's what I've kind of done with Reinhabited Volume 1 and 2 baseline for this study. It was one way for me to be able to stand a little bit more in depth of what it was. And then from there, all that down, I ended up taking it and doing more research on it to fill in some of the books that were even not mentioned in the re-inhabited books. If you turn around and you filled everything, you know, even with the Bible, with everything that's not written, we would, our libraries would be absolutely massive, more than they are today. But if you've ever wondered, when you have gone through history classes or civics classes, or even, you know, constitutional classes, law classes, anything like that, and ever wondered, there's something missing about this story. It just doesn't feel complete. But those teachers are constantly trying to make you feel like it's the full story. Well, if you if you've had that kind of feeling, then you have some sense of discernment of what is truly going on. And through this study, it has been trying to be able to, it's an attempt, I should say, to be able to help others, to be able to understand some of those gaps and what it is to fill those gaps in there. And then on top of that, and this is probably the most important thing about it, is to encourage you and to light a spark in you to turn around and go out and start researching a lot of this yourself. Because one of the things that I'll tell you straight off, every piece of information I have is either on the internet, in books, and also namely in the re-inhabited books. But all of this stuff, if you search hard enough and know where to search, whether online, in libraries, in books, you're going to find this information. And even, you know, this is still a broad coverage on it. It goes a little more in depth in certain areas, but it's still a broad piece. So, again, I encourage you, and I hope to light that spark in each and every one of you to start researching even deeper. And I know you've already started that, or you wouldn't be here, because that's the one thing that, that pretty much every one of us in the Republic, there's been a spark in us that there's something missing. So, we have come full circle in trying to find what those things are. Again, these events and thing and the information about those events that I'm about to speak about is history. They are facts. They are not conspiracy and they're theories. If there is anything that I mentioned that is a theory, and in my definition of a theory is that I myself have not fully corroborated that information, I will express it that it is a theory, whether it's mine or somebody else's. If not, I will express it that it's fact if I have fully corroborated that information. I like to be transparent and honest with everybody on that fact from the get-go. So, let us jump in where we were leaving off last week and moving on with John F. Kennedy. John F. Kennedy was elected the 35th President of the United States, taking office January 20th of 1961. The first attempt to re-inhabit the Republic came with JFK. And there's also an interesting connection between JFK and Reagan when it comes to our monetary currencies. So, President Kennedy signed an executive order, number 11110, or 11110. And in this, it says the authority vested in the president by paragraph B of section 43 of the Act of May 12, 1933, as amended in 31 U.S.C. 821, paragraph B, to issue silver certificates against any silver bullion, silver, or standard silver dollars in the Treasury, not then held for redemption of any outstanding silver certificates, to prescribe the denominations of such silver certificates, and to coin standard silver dollars and subsidiary silver currency for their redemption. Now, with this, if you've ever seen a silver certificate, you look at the top of that silver certificate, and it will say silver certificate, meaning, as we've talked about last week about birth certificates, a silver certificate is redeemable for the silver. A birth certificate is redeemable for the money in which that person, from the time that they were born, has generated. So, with a silver certificate, you are supposed to be able to walk into a bank and to be able to say, I want the currency traded for the value of this this silver certificate in silver. And they are supposed to give you the amount of silver that is equivalent to whatever the bill that you have, the $1, $2, or $5. Now, the interesting thing with this executive order that Kennedy had put forth, it was actually to promote more of the silver certificates, because they had already been approved before, but his thing was to promote more of the silver certificates in $1 and $2 denominations, as well as the silver dollars, standard silver dollars, to promote more of those. Now, this was supposed to have been in order to bridge a gap with things that were going on with the Fed. Excuse me. And it was supposed to eventually eliminate the silver certificates and use the federal, to completely go with Federal Reserve notes. But with all those issues that were going on with the banks and everything, this was kind of one of those pieces to kind of bridge that gap during that time frame. And we're going to kind of come back in just a second to the elimination piece, quote unquote. So the executive order amended a different executive order that was dated in September 17th of 1951, which was Executive Order 10289, by delegating to the Secretary of the Treasury that the President's authority to issue silver certificates under the Thomas Amendment of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, as amended by the Gold Reserve Act. Now, the Gold Reserve Act, if anybody is familiar with it, that's when we had actual gold-backed currency. Don't have any of those anymore. The order allowed the Secretary to issue silver certificates if any were needed during the transition period under President Kennedy's plan to eliminate silver certificates and use the Federal Reserve notes. Now, understand what I just read there, that he was allowed to issue silver certificates if any were needed. Exact words, if any were needed during the transition period. Now, many, how they say, to the victor gets to write history. So in most history books, what you will find is that Kennedy's plan was to have the silver certificates as a fallback as the transition went further into the Federal Reserve notes. However, what was actually written and found through President Kennedy's memoirs, through private interviews, and even from discussions from his own family, that this was all basically a ruse that Kennedy was trying to use in order to limit the Federal Reserve's power and to bring them out of it and return the country to the Republic and return currency where it was originally supposed to be and was supposed to stay with the Treasury. So the thing that Kennedy was attempting to do under the guise of trying to bolster the government's spending and monetary values, and to use those silver certificates. His plan was actually and to be able to use those certificates to remove the Fed and to do even more of the silver certificates. And the interesting thing is it even passed through Congress. The House of Representatives took up a president's request earlier in 1963 and passed H.R. 5389 on April 10th of 1963. And it was a vote by 251 to 112. The Senate passed the bill on May 23rd with a vote of 68 to 10. Kennedy ended up signing the bill into law on June 4th of 1963. And on the same day, he signed the executive order 11110 authorizing the Treasury Secretary to continue printing the silver certificates during the transition period. And that act became Public Law 88-36 or 77 Statute 54. It repealed the Silver Purchase Act of 1934 and other related laws. It repealed a tax on silver transfers and authorized the Federal Reserve to issue $1 and $2 bills in addition to the notes that were already issued. Now, the interesting thing with this specific order is even though he had pushed this and it ended up getting through Congress, it didn't last very long. So, excuse me. One of the big things about it is this was signed into law on June 4th, 1963. Kennedy was assassinated in November of 1963. So it was just a few months later that he actually was assassinated, and from that point, the statute didn't even really hold up anymore. Once LBJ, and we'll get to him in a minute, but as soon as LBJ got into office, he basically tore down everything that Kennedy was working towards. Sound familiar from Lincoln, right? So the Silver Purchase Act that came into play authorized and required the Secretary of the Treasury to buy silver and issue silver certificates. With its repeal, the President needed to delegate to the Treasury Secretary that the President's own authority under the Agricultural Adjustment Act by issuing the executive order. And therefore, the president was able to continue the secretary's authority. So even though that the bill had passed through law, the Treasury works for the executive, and the president ended up giving that executive order of 11110 to the Secretary of Treasury, telling him, now you start printing these things out. So you can see kind of how the line of this started going through. While retaining their status as legal tender, the silver certificates had effectively been retired from use as of today, in today's time frame. The Treasury Secretary C. Douglas Dillon, in March of 1964, halted redemption of silver certificates for silver dollars as Kennedy had intended. And then as of March 25th of 1964, silver certificates would be redeemed only in silver bullion. On June 24th of 68, all redemption in silver ceased from that point forward. and that was LBJ. In the 1970s, large numbers of remaining silver dollars in the mint vaults were sold to collecting public for collector's value. So even though these silver dollars were still in the vaults, right, they were not being sent out for being able to be redeemable and used as legal tender, only for collector's values. So even, and this is kind of where you get a silver dollar, it's supposed to be $1, and because of the collector's value of it, you could end up at, you know, depending upon the year on it and possible misstamping or, you know, whatever. You know, that $1 that was supposed to be redeemable for $1 worth of silver could end up, you know, due to collector's values, being $100, you know, or a couple hundred dollars. Just depends upon what the collectors end up valuing that particular coin. Be very careful, though, with all these mint pieces that are out there saying, you know, you can buy 20 pieces of gold or silver for $49.99 a month, right? Yeah, most of them are layered. They're not full silver or full gold or pure silver. They're layered. They got lead in them. So be very, very careful. That is the one piece of financial advice that I can give from personal experience. I've had some gifts given to me with some of those things, and it's gold layered. In 1982, Congress repealed the remaining legislative authority behind Executive Order 11110 with the passage of Public Legislation 97-258. On September 9th of 1987, as part of a general cleanup of executive orders. Now, most presidents don't come into office and even care about what another president did in their executive orders, and, you know, they just continue on. And this is one reason why we end up with laws on our books that are so old and so irrelevant that they mean nothing. But nobody's willing to go back in and remove them off the books. You also have executive orders that, if we probably went back and looked at every single one of them, which according to a constitutional laws, executive orders are unconstitutional anyway, unless they are used as a way to say, as the executive, I am directing my subordinates to do this, not as in executive order to create a law, as many do today. An executive decree is basically saying, hey, we've decided that all flags are going to be flown at half mast for the death of so-and-so. Or we're designating this day as a memorial day for so-and-so. You know, things like that is an executive decree, which is different than an executive order. But there are reasons for executive orders and executive decrees, but when they turn around and start using them to make law, that is unconstitutional. There's a totally different, they have really changed without legally changing. They just de facto changed, if you will, the definition of what those two are supposed to be. Okay, so the thing is President Reagan came in, and Reagan decided that he was going to go through a lot of the executive orders in the past and kind of clean up what was going on and try to make sure that he wasn't redoing what somebody else had already done, or counteracting something that he didn't know about. So they started going through and checking all these executive orders. And as I mentioned, in 1982, they basically repealed the remaining legislative authority of the executive order 11110. So at this point, Reagan had issued an executive order 12608 and removed the text which had been added in executive order 10289 by the executive order 11110 and revoked the rest of that executive order period. He basically went through and took that out and said, hey, the legislature has removed this from law. It's no longer even needed, and boom, it's gone. But the crazy thing about it is it was stopped already within 5 months of his assassination. Within 5 months of, even 5 months of it passing, him, you know, him, JFK and issuing the executive order. Within 5 months, it was already dead in the water because he was assassinated and he wasn't there to make sure it was carried on, and LBJ could care less. But it took from 63 to 87, 24 years for them to finally take it off the books and rescind it. That's quite a few presidents in between there. And that's kind of that interesting connection between JFK and Reagan. So an author named Jim Mars has a book called Crossfire. And he presented the theory that Kennedy was trying to rein in the power of the Federal Reserve, and that forces opposed to such action might have played some part in Kennedy's assassination. Now, we all know that there's so many, and I mean a plethora, of theories as to who was behind or who played a part in Kennedy's assassination. And there's a few that I'm going to talk about tonight as well that are out there. And again, they are theories. And when those come out, I will definitely state that fact as well, that they are theories. So anyway, Mars alleged that the issuance of the executive order was an effort by Kennedy to transfer that power from the Federal Reserve to the Department of the Treasury by replacing the Federal Reserve notes with the silver certificates, as I mentioned earlier. This is one of the accounts in which came that is not actually out in history books, but it's one of the accounts that has been put into literature concerning that fact. Another author, Richard Belzer, named the responsible parties in his theory as American billionaires, power brokers, and bankers working in tandem with the three-letter agency, CIA, and other sympathetic agents of the government. The whispered theory is Kennedy was basically attempting to pull one over on the Fed. And once the silver certificates were in production and accepted into the law, it would make a path to remove the Fed. Because once you have the Treasury printing money again, what do you need the Fed for? They're printing money that's not even worth anything. It's just not even worth the paper that and the ink that's used to print it on. Now, this portion that I'm about to get in right now is very touchy. It is very touchy. There are some portions of it that are theory. There are some portions of it that are fact according to publication of this person's resume, his memoirs, and his official biography. Okay? The person we are talking about is former President George H.W. Bush, or Bush Sr., as many know. Many believed he was such a great president. But, however, there were many, many dark shadows encircled around him. And there are many, many, many dark theories that encircle him still, even in his passing. So George H.W. Bush was suspected in numerous scandals throughout his public life and his private life. But before we move forward, everyone must understand not everyone who is associated with our country's three-letter agencies are publicly known. They're not going to always be put into a resume. You're not going to find out about it in a background check because their connections are so classified, you ain't going to find anything about them. Even as an intelligence officer, with the clearance that I had when I was on active duty, yeah, I wouldn't have even been able to find it. I would have to have been in the upper echelons of the who's who, and I wasn't. many of people that are within some of these three-letter agencies, the NSA, FBI, CIA, you know, even when you start getting into some of the international pieces, many of them are recruited in college. Some of them are part of societies, which can influence a person's ascension into these ranks, and most of those would be secret societies. Some are partially secret, partially not. And in some of those, we're talking about the Skull and Bones, the Freemasonry, the Knights of Columbus, even technically somewhat in with the Catholic Church if they have the connections to the Vatican. Just a regular Catholic Church is not going to have those kind of connections. But if they're connected to where they can get somebody from the Vatican, the Pope, or somebody along those lines to vouch for them, then, yeah, it's possible. So the thing with Bush is there are conflicting accounts as to where he was, when he was, and who is he working for at the particular times. At the time of JFK's assassination, there is the possibility that Bush, as a young CIA agent, was stationed in Houston, Texas. And there, it is speculated that he was involved in JFK's assassination in some form or fashion. Now, the interesting thing about that is that Bush claims that he, and for that matter, the CIA and the FBI, claim that there was no affiliation between the agencies and Bush. But interestingly, Bush's resume shows that he was beginning his political career in West Texas at the time. However, a lot of suspicion still lingers on there. You have people that you never knew and probably never will know that was actually part of the CIA or part of the FBI that they ended up using and putting into these positions in order to be able to control that position. So some critics of the official findings theorized that George Bush was involved in the assassination as a CIA operative in Dealey Plaza. In the book, Plausible Denial, was the CIA involved in the assassination of JFK? An American attorney, Mark Lane, suggests that Bush worked out of a Houston office as a CIA agent at the time of the assassination. In the book Family Secrets, Russ Barker, the author, contends that Bush became an intelligence agent in his teenage years his late teenage years, and was later at the center of a plot to assassinate Kennedy that included his father, Prescott Bush, Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, the CIA Director Alan Dulles, the Cubans and Russian exiles and immigrants, and various Texas oilmen. Now, interesting enough, if you go back and remember, I said I was trying to get a spark in y'all to go and do some research on your own. One of the things that you might want to go and research is Bush's father, Prescott Bush, and what all he was involved in. Because he goes back with some very dark secrets in his past. So, according to Barker, Bush was in Dallas on the night before and the morning of the assassination. On November 29th of 1963, exactly 1 week after the assassination, an employee of the FBI wrote in a memo that Mr. George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency was given a briefing on the reaction to the assassination by Cuban exiles living in Miami. Joseph McBride speculated that the George Bush cited in the memo was the future U.S. president, who was appointed head of the CIA by President Gerald Ford in 76, 13 years after the assassination. Now, I'm going to pause there for a second. How in the world could somebody that was supposedly just, you know, breaking his teeth into one of the largest intelligence agencies in the world, and 13 years later, he is now being appointed as the head of CIA, but allegedly never had any association before? 13 years, and he's now the head of the CIA. Just that there alone shoots so many holes into the background and the official accounting of George Bush's past and what happened from 63 to 76. Now, during Bush's presidential campaign in 1988, the memo dealing with this about Bush being briefed about the Cuban exiles in Miami resurfaced. And at that point, it prompted the CIA to claim that the memo was referring to an employee named George William Bush. However, George William Bush was interviewed, and he disputed this suggestion, declaring under oath, "I am not the George Bush of the Central Intelligence Agency referred to in this memorandum." Now, will we ever get the truth about this? I think eventually we will, but the truth is going to eventually come out about, you know, everything. How soon that will be, I'm not sure, but it is very interesting. I don't know how many of y'all seen the funeral for George H.W. Bush and the envelopes that pretty much everybody in the first three rows, including the family, ended up getting, that it was supposedly from George Bush before he died to give out to everybody, warning them they know everything. I'm sorry. You can look it up on this is going to sound really bad, but you can look it up on YouTube. Take out videos of it everywhere. I hate to use that kind of reference, but it is one place that you can find it. And there's been verifiable proof of those envelopes being there, and that's what the card had in them. They were actually handed out by the Secret Service to each person that was supposed to get it. So now, let me pause right there real quick before I go into this other one. I want to open it up to the floor to any questions real quick. Anybody got any questions, comments?
All right, everybody. If you want to ask a comment or ask a question or make a comment, you can press star 6 on your phone to unmute and star 6 to remute yourself. Or you can try to press your phone for mute, and the floor is open.
Yes, this is Representative David Schmidt requesting the floor, please.
Right here.
Yeah, thank you. Another really good book is George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography by Webster Tarpley and Anton Chaitkin. That was published in 1992. And then the publisher is Executive Intelligence Review. And that was run by Lyndon LaRouche. I just thought I'd bring that up. And with that, I yield the floor. Oh, another thing before I do that, Abraham Zapruder, that did that, did the film that there, the and video, and he was a 32nd degree Freemason. And right at the day after that, there he got his 33rd degree without a yield.
Oh, wow! Thank you, for that information.
Yeah, I got piles of stuff on that. And oh, yeah, I forgot one more thing. Somebody about 15, 18 years ago, somebody sent me an actual photograph of Bush Sr. standing at Dealey Plaza.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, yeah, if okay, you would, if you would, find me on Wire, and it's at DWEIERMANN. If you could find me on there, send me a friends request. I would love to collaborate with you.
I'll tell you what. Why don't okay? How about I think your email address would be a little easier. So I don't have time.
Yes.
No, I'm not on Wire, so I don't have time for that.
Okay. Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah, email would be better. Do you have it?
Not offhand. If you can give it to me again,
it's Bell B E L L. County Justice, no gaps. One, just put it all as one word, at gmail.com.
Yep, got it. Thank you. Okay,
all right, thank you, sir.
Yep.
Awesome. Anybody else? Okay. All right. So moving on. Now, when it comes to conspiracy theories, I'm one of those that every good fact comes from a theory that was brought up before. Now, conspiracies, yeah, it's a little bit different of a theory, but it's interesting when some theories, and some that would label them as conspiracy theories, put things together, and sometimes they can create a theory out of just about anything. However, there are a great deal of similarities between the life of Lincoln and the life of Kennedy. And, you know, where we turn around and we say, how many coincidences does there have to be before there's a story behind it? And it's no longer a conspiracy or a theory, but there's something else at play. Now, that something else at play could be God himself and is showing us some things. Not saying that it definitely is, but I'm saying it could be. So let's take a look at this, because some of these things are very, very interesting, and the things with between Kennedy and Lincoln, Kennedy seemed to be trying to finish many of the things that Lincoln didn't get a chance to. And then Kennedy was cut off. Now we have Trump trying to finish what both of them started, and they're still trying to kill him. So it's very interesting how a lot of these things through history will align. But just bear with me. This is kind of a freebie. The comparing Kennedy's death to Lincoln's gives you a host of weird coincidences. Some of those examples are both presidents were shot in the back of the head on the Friday before a major holiday while seated beside their wives, neither of whom were injured. Both were in the presence of another couple, and in each case, that man was also wounded by the assassin. After both assassinations, there were loud and insistent claims that the fatal shot must have come from a different direction. Each president in his 30s married a socially prominent 24-year-old girl who spoke French fluently. While in the White House, each president had a family of three children and lost a child through death. Both Lincoln and Kennedy were second children. Both had been boat captains. Both were related to a U.S. senator, an attorney general, an ambassador to Great Britain, and the mayor of Boston. Each had been elected to Congress in the year of 47 and were vice presidential runner-ups in the year of 56. Each was elected president in 60. Before each was elected, a sister died. Both had a friend named Billy Graham and knew an Adlai Stevenson. President Kennedy had a secretary named Mrs. Lincoln, and President Lincoln had a secretary named John Kennedy. The names Lincoln and Kennedy each contained seven letters. Both were succeeded by vice presidents named Johnson, Andrew born in 1808 and Lyndon in 1908, both of whom had 13 letters in their names and also coincidentally had two daughters. Both assassins had 15 letters in their names and went by their full names, all three names. Booth shot Lincoln in a theater and fled to a warehouse, while Oswald shot Kennedy from a warehouse and fled to a theater. Both assassins were in their turn assassinated by shooters who used a Colt revolver and fired only one shot, which was fatal. Now, it's very interesting on a lot of the coincidences between the two. Now, does it mean anything? Not really. Just interesting facts to know, coincidences to know on some of these things. But maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, of the alignment between the two. The one thing I haven't done is looking at the alignment between the two and then with Trump right now. That's a whole nother gambit. So anyway, back to President Kennedy. The thing with President Kennedy in trying to re-inhabit the republic at that particular time, he was not necessarily working alone. Many of us know about the generals. There was a group of military generals known as the Council of Generals or the Army of Virginia. And these men were and are patriots to the core. Now, remember that if you've ever served in the military or you have a family member that served in the military or even know somebody that served in the military, when we take our oath of office, and depending if you've been in for a long time, you may end up taking that oath of office numerous times. Every time you re-up, every time you get promoted, and so forth, you end up taking that oath again. And that oath is to the Constitution of the United States, not to the President, not to a Secretary, not to Congress, to the Constitution of the United States. And we take that oath very, very, very seriously. But I want you to remember those guys, and we're going to come back to them here shortly. But understand, from the time that Kennedy was working on this and he was assassinated, these men, these generals, came into play at that point. And they have been waiting and preparing ever since. So shortly after JFK's assassination, and I mean within an hour, I believe it was very, very quick, Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson was sworn in as the next president. LBJ, as he's also known, being a 33rd degree Freemason, a member of the Illuminati, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, quickly began to dismantle all the advances JFK had accomplished. LBJ then passed the Coinage Act of 1965, where dimes, quarters, half dollars, and dollars, which had contained 90% silver, and the silver and the value of it was removed. He had now taken exactly what JFK was trying to do with the silver and completely removed it now, even from the coins that were already being put out that had the 90% silver in them. That's one reason why they say today, you know, even pennies are made of copper, allegedly, you know, but nickels and quarters and dimes, they're practically aluminum or lead, with as much corruption as in them. So the thing is when he passed, when he ended up signing this, and it went through Congress and everything, and he passed the Coinage Act in 65, it was a violation of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution of the United States. And not just, you know, the original Constitution, but even the de facto Constitution, it's still there. It says, no state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payments of debts. So all the money, even with the Fed, the way that they're doing stuff right now, that our money is not backed by anything other than a promise, basically, somebody's word. It's completely unconstitutional because it clearly states that it's supposed to be gold or silver tender. So if those bills are there, they're supposed to be backed up by gold or silver, not anything else. As well as any coins that are made are supposed to be made of gold or silver. Anybody remember the gold dollars, the Sacagawean gold dollars that had started a while back, and then all of a sudden they just faded out again? Yeah, that was another attempt to be able to try to bring the gold back into it, but that didn't last very long either. I don't know for sure, and this is my theory on that one. As I mentioned, if it's a theory, then I will definitely state it. My theory on that is that the Fed ended up seeing that there was a possible threat that this was going to be, you know, it was going to get popular and was going to start rearing its head again. And said, oh, no, 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 no. So at that point, it was, you know, cut loose. So the question is, did LBJ have a part in JFK's assassination? There are many, many people that have asked that question since the actual time it happened to today. And there is a lot of evidence that suggests that he definitely did. Unless you really know how the inner workings of the Kennedy administration really operated, you probably wouldn't know just how much turmoil there was between the Kennedys and Johnson. Both JFK as well as his brother RFK or Bobby Kennedy, both of them could not stand Johnson, Lyndon Johnson. They could not stand him. I mean, they'd make a mockery out of him all the time. So he felt like he was just, you know, kind of a third wheel in all of this anyway. And he had his own political aspirations after being VP and trying to move up. But that was not in the Kennedys' plans, if you will. So here's a few pieces to kind of ponder on as to, did LBJ have a part in his assassination, in JFK's assassination? And if he did not, why were some of these things allowed to happen? And why did he order some of these things to happen? So the first part was that it was to get JFK's body out of Dallas and deliver it into the hands of the military, where they would have control over the narrative. First thing in any cover-up is to control the narrative. Make sure that nobody has evidence to the contrary of the narrative that you're putting out. Keep in mind that JFK's murder was, at this particular time, it was a state criminal offense. At this particular time in 63, there was not a federal crime to assassinate a president. It was underneath state jurisdiction. So in that case, the state in which it occurred, it was considered a murder. An assassination would be a first-degree murder or capital offense in the state of Texas. There was not a federal crime if you assassinated a president at that particular time. So therefore, federal agencies had absolutely no jurisdiction whatsoever. CIA, FBI, Pentagon, nobody. None of them had any jurisdiction in there. However, he was removed out of there, and Texas was taken out of the loop of all this. And under Texas law, the Dallas County medical examiner, Dr. Earl Rose, was required to perform an autopsy on JFK's body immediately after JFK was declared dead. However, Rose announced that he was going to perform the autopsy, and Secret Service stormed in and said, "Oh, no, you're not." Rose refused to give up ground, insisting, correctly so, that Texas law required him to perform autopsy before the body could be released. One of the Secret Service agency physically picked up Rose. This is Rose's accounting, that he was picked up and carried him to a nearby wall, wagging his finger in his face and telling him they were taking the body. While others pulled back their suitcase, brandished their guns, thereby threatening to use deadly force against anyone who got in their way. They were taking the body before an autopsy was done. A man named Kellerman declared that he and his team were simply following orders, which is the Secret Service agent Kellerman, that they were simply following orders. There is only one person who could give that kind of extraordinary order to a Secret Service agent to nullify basically the state from doing what they were supposed to do by law. And that's LBJ. He's the only one that could have given that order to do that, either directly or indirectly through Kellerman's superiors, the Secret Service agent's superiors. Who else would have dared to issue the order to violate state criminal law? Even though LBJ was a citizen of Texas, he knew the law. He served in the legislature here in Texas before he even went to D.C. He knew the law. But he knew that if they got a hold of him and did the autopsy, that there was no way that they were going to be able to control the narrative. In fact, Johnson's own actions confirmed that he was the person who gave the order. Because once JFK was declared dead, Johnson headed to Love Field, where he ordered seats to be removed from Air Force One to make room for the big casket in which JFK's body had been placed in. Johnson had absolutely no intention in waiting at Love Field for 2 to 3 hours that would be needed to complete the autopsy. And that's a quick autopsy. He was removing the seats in full expectation that the casket and the body would be arriving shortly. If he wasn't the one that had given that order, how would he have known that quickly? Or at least been in the loop of knowing that order was given and did nothing about it. Because he was the one that would have had to have issued that order to get JFK's body out of Parkland at all costs and deliver it to Love Field on Air Force One. If there was no reason to conceal the reasoning behind JFK's assassination or how, then why was an autopsy not performed as law demanded? And the person that was about to be sworn in as the next president not protecting what the law was in the state and what the law demanded. So another role that LBJ had was to ensure that there would never be an official investigation that could lead to the national security establishment, including, of course, the military's fraudulent autopsy. That was the purpose of appointing former CIA Director Alan Dulles to the Warren Commission. Dulles was not loved. He had no love for the Kennedys either, because he was fired by JFK after the Bay of Pigs disaster. And after, you know, basically the Bay of Pigs was pinned on him, he loathed Kennedy. He had no love whatsoever for Kennedy. So LBJ turned around and appointed him to lead the Warren Commission. He'll turn around and write anything they wanted him to. And he ensured that the commission stayed on track with the official lone nut narrative. There has been so many people over so many years that have done the studies and have pointed out, and you get these nut jobs that try saying that there's a magic bullet, that it did a 180 or a 45 degree angle after exiting the body and it turned around and went back. I mean, what are we doing, whistling a bullet to change directions like Guardians of the Galaxy or something? I mean, that's some far-fetched stuff. Instead of actually realizing, you know, that there is no way that one bullet or two from the same direction was going to do the damage that it did. And this is the reason why the autopsy was not being allowed to be done in Dallas. Because at that point, they would have realized when you look at a, I don't know how many of y'all have ever really looked at how a gunshot wound is dealt with, but you have an entry point and then an exit point usually, unless it gets caught up in between, but you usually have an entry point and an exit point, and you can distinctly tell the two apart. And so if you got one entry in the front and another entry in the back, you got a bullet come, those two bullets are coming from two different directions. These are the kind of things they did not want coming out in that initial autopsy. They needed the narrative to be sold the way they wanted it to be put out. It was the only way that, that any of this was going to work. So the next milestone, or excuse me, let me rephrase that, not necessarily a milestone, but a millstone that was hanging around LBJ's neck was JFK's own brother, which was Robert F. Kennedy, or Bobby Kennedy, as he was also known. He was the Attorney General at the time. Now, the whole plan between John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy was that Robert Kennedy was supposed to follow in the footsteps of Big Brother and become the next president after JFK was completed with his terms. And, however, never came to fruition. JFK was assassinated November 22nd of 1963. His brother Robert stayed in office as the Attorney General until September 3rd of 1964, just shy of a year from the assassination. Bobby Kennedy left to run for the U.S. Senate from New York in 64, and he won, where he served until June 6th of 1968, where he too was assassinated while in office. He was running for the next presidential election, and he had become the front runner for the Democrat nomination for the presidency. And it cost him his life because they did not want the next Kennedy in office. Much like we have seen recently, someone does not want secrets revealed. We've seen this happen with our own eyes today, that Trump getting back into office, knowing some of the secrets, and knowing where to get them and how to release them. And then you got Robert Kennedy Jr. that is there working with him now, that has been on a mission for a long time to get all of these, you know, secret files declassified and released. When you got somebody that's in there that has the power and the ambition to get these things released, it's going to end up concerning some people. It's going to concern people. People are going to try to go into survival mode, and you've seen what they've been trying to do to Trump. I'm honestly surprised that they're just doing character attacks on Kennedy, but he's not the one that has the declassification authority. The ultimate, if anybody doesn't know that, that the ultimate declassification authority on anything in the United States is the active United States president. Not a former president cannot do that. Once he is out of office, he can no longer declassify stuff. However, if he is sitting in that Oval Office, and that is his legitimate position, I say it again, his legitimate position as president, then he is the ultimate classification authority. Anybody below him has to have delegated authorities. So you have a lot of secrets throughout the years that are just waiting to be busted loose and let out. And he's already declassified them. I still don't know why everything hasn't been put out yet. It's kind of like the Epstein list too, right? Anyway. All right. Let's see here. We'll save that for a second. So let's fast forward a little bit to 1990. The reason why we're going to kind of fast forward from the 60s to 1990 is because of things that are relevant really kind of to us and what the Republic is doing is why I'm jumping ahead in the timeline. So, on August 2nd, 1990, facto President George H.W. Bush, we're going to come back to him now, pronounced the name of the global takeover agenda by those who seek world domination when he announced the title of New World Order in his Gulf War speech. There has been indications of it, you know, little hints here and there of it. However, this is the first time that an American president announced the using the coined term New World Order officially in any speech. Now, about 2 years later, in June of 92, the United Nations had held a Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And at this Earth Summit, there was a presentation that was made of a plan for the 21st century in a document called the UN Sustainable Development Agenda 21. Today, it's simply referred to as the Agenda 21. However, while in office, this de facto president signed the document on behalf of the United States with a pledge to adopt all of its goals. Now, this is truly going into a New World Order stance, because this now meant that the American people have been brought under an international control and authority under what some consider the Illuminati communist-controlled United Nations. So he basically sold us out. The de facto president, addressing the General Assembly of the United Nations on February 1st of 1992, made this statement. It is the sacred principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter to which the American people will henceforth pledge their allegiance. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I have never seen in any of my oaths, whether it was in the military, as a police officer, as part of this republic, or pretty much anything else, where I have pledged my allegiance to the United Nations or any other international entity. So, don't know where he thought he had the right to do that, but apparently he tried it. He did it. Agenda 21 is a plan by the elite of the world towards their global New World Order agenda to control the world based entirely on socialist control mechanisms. And the objectives are laid out in the documents include the end to national sovereignty, the abolishment of private property, the restructure of the family unit. Why does that sound so familiar? Increasing limitations and restrictions on mobility and individual opportunity. A lot of fascism in that. Now, you remember where I had mentioned that how in the world did somebody in just 13 years move up so far into the CIA to become the director? Well, if you remember some of the things that I mentioned that are kind of quirky about Mr. Bush's early years. So during World War II, He had joined the U.S. Navy as an aviator and flew in the Pacific Theater. He also attended Yale College, was the president of the Delta Kappa Epsilon fraternity, later a member of the Pi Beta Kappa fraternity. And then eventually he was initiated into the Skull and Bones secret society, like his father, and his son after him, Bush Jr. In January of 76 was when Bush was assigned as the director of the CIA. So does anything in George H.W. Bush's past really align in all of the different accusations, if you will, of what his past is supposed to have been? When you're in secret societies and when you're so deep into secret relations with three-letter agencies, there's so many irregularities within his entire life. But if you want to do more, do some more research on all that. Now, I know we're, how much more time do we have?
You can take as much time as you'd like to.
Okay.
Another half an hour? Does that be enough?
I will try.
Okay.
I will try.
You can come back next Sunday if you like too. It's up to you.
If we need to, we can do that, and we can even go into a question and answering session if need be for next week on some of it too. But let me cover this real quick. One of the big things that kind of went widely unknown, and it has been a huge, huge cover-up ever since it happened. The effects of the events on 9/11 ended up bringing the country together for a certain amount of time, very strong together, united with American pride and patriotism, and on top of that, turning to God. The nation ended up coming together with patriotism and turning to God for a very short time. Long enough time for the country's leadership to be able to mastermind and pull all the sheep right in line with the narrative that they wanted to be able to get what they wanted. So I'm going to go through a little bit of information here on what was missed with 9/11. Many of you have heard of NESERA, the National Economic Security and Recovery Act, and we've been waiting for its implementation because that's pretty much when we're going to be kicking off and doing our part, more actively at least. So the act was actually passed by the U.S. Congress in the year of 2000, yet was never proclaimed and put into action. It was set to be announced and implemented on September 11th of 2001. There was a meeting and a press conference that was supposed to go out at 10 a.m. on September 11th. But the World Trade Center buildings were attacked just before 9 a.m. As a matter of fact, as we know it, American Airlines Flight 11 flew into the North Tower of the World Trade Center complex at 8:46. 17 minutes later, United Airlines Flight 175 hit the South Tower. Both collapsed within an hour and 41 minutes of the impact, destroying the remaining five structures in the complex. Well, the interesting thing about it is one of them that was not hit but was destroyed was Building 5 and Building 7. building five, I believe it was five, that had all of the banking information for all the gold depositories. Interestingly enough, everything in there was destroyed. Nacera is designed to erase poverty and all its attendant ills from the earth during a transitional period preceding ascension of the planet, and bringing the sovereignty back to the people so that people, sovereign people, can focus their attention on the planet, on the family, and bringing prosperity back to everything that God initially created. Right? God never intended any of us to be in poverty. He never intended us to end up destroying our planet and different things. He never intended that when somebody is given an idea that can help all of mankind, to tuck it away so that others can end up making billions and trillions of dollars off of something else to put in its place instead of it being free to people. So with that, you kind of can understand why they killed Kennedy, first off, why they're trying to stop President Trump, and then on top of that, why 9/11 happened. So with Nacera, now understand this, you're going to hear two terms at different times, Nacera and Jusera, with a G. Nacera is for the United States only. Jusera is a global, worldwide, for lack of better terms, reset. And it brings back the gold-backed currency. So some of the things that are supposed to happen, and this is not an exhaustive list, but some of the things that are supposed to happen during Nacera is all debts are erased, the constitutional law is restored, the beginning and creation of peace in, you know, worldwide. Now, understand biblically that none of this is going to last, but it's still supposed to come through prophetically. This is also very sound, you know, prophetically as well. Disclosed suppressed technologies, mainly talking about like Tesla and his patents that he had. He's got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of patents that would end up helping so many across the world, and so much of it would become free for everybody. Well, we wouldn't have to worry about that. Medmeds and the medical community and cancer cures and other diseases and cures that's already there. But Big Pharma is making plenty of money without it being put out there, keeping people sick. And there's a lot more that goes along with those things, too, that of technologies that are out there. The quantum financial system and the quantum voting system, they are already in place and ready to go. They just have to be given the green light to switch over to them. As I mentioned earlier, we return to the gold-backed U.S. dollar. The Fed and the IRS would be reconstituted and folded back into the Department of Treasury, where they are no longer private, they are ran by the government the way it's supposed to be. And technically, the IRS would be abolished, and we have the ERS, or the External Revenue Service. And that's where the tariffs and all that stuff comes into play. And then the Fed, not necessarily the Fed being folded in, but the jobs of the Fed would be folded into the Department of Treasury. So them printing money, them dealing with the interest rates and all that stuff, it'll go back to the people that it was supposed to be at all along, which was by Constitution underneath the Department of Treasury. We would replace the income tax with a national sales tax. Don't have all the, fluffy specifics on that piece, but they're supposed to end up going to national sales tax and getting away from the income tax, and I believe that also part of some of the tariff pieces as well. Abolish the compound interest on secure loans. Ooh, interesting. The other thing about that, about erasing all debts, if you no longer have a Federal Reserve note, and all of your loans are saying that it is supposed to be paid back with the under the U.S. dollar of Federal Reserve notes, and yet now that's been abolished, how's your loan supposed to stay intact to say you got to pay in Federal Reserve notes, right, instead of Treasury notes or Treasury certificates? Two different currencies. All those loans go bye bye because they're null and void now. And then the big part for us as the Republic is sitting in and holding the positions during the time frame of the transition is that there is a new election to bring in the new de jure government within 120 days of the implementation. And that's from president to dog catcher, if you vote in your dog catcher, right? But, I mean, from the top to your lowest level election position within a county or a township, right? Every single one of them have to be reelected into a republic de jure government. So that's going to be a lot to deal with. However, it's got to be done. Now, we mentioned a little bit ago about 9/11 and so forth. Does anybody really know the truth as to the reason why we went into Iraq? It wasn't for oil. It wasn't for weapons of mass destruction. It wasn't for liberating the people. It wasn't for, what was the other thing, the chemicals that were being used. Now, don't get me wrong. Saddam Hussein and his sons were some dirty, sadistic people. I was over there when we caught them. They were some really, bad people, right? So don't get it twisted. I'm not defending them. However, what the big problem was is that Hussein would not join the deep state and join in with the BRICS conglomeration with the backing of all the riches that Iraq had. So they concocted all this stuff up in there to be able to go in there. Remember where I was talking about all that patriotism and everything, and now you got all the sheep on one mind, in one mind of patriotism. We got to go after these people. So now you turn around and you just start developing a story that everybody will go along with. And how, what's the best way to do that? You control the narrative. Their narrative never was put out. Now, do I feel that us going in there and quote-unquote liberating the people from the Hussein regime was a good thing? Absolutely. However, it ended up quickly changing once we took them out of power. We are now fighting not Iraqis, not the Iraqi regime. We're fighting terrorists that were coming in from other countries that are coming in there. Completely different war. And not too many people really understand all those things if you were not there in it and talking with the people or understand a lot of the awakening of what's going on. So So we're going to move on real quick on this last piece here, and then we'll call it a night and pick up next week on Mr. Turner. So you remember the Council of Generals, the generals that I had mentioned. So these are military leaders who were actually not just generals. They're full-bird colonels and above. Majority of them were and are generals, but there are some full-bird colonels that are mixed in there as well. Some are retired. Some are still active. These are what you'll hear mixed in the different broadcasts and podcasts and stuff, known as the White Hats, the White Hat military. Those are these guys. Now, you also have the guys that are known as the Red Hats that were part of the White Hat military of this council, yet they're being led by a colonel that decided that there was needing to be some more action taken. And when I mean action taken, I'm talking about decisive, kinetic action, going in and actually taking out black hat people, deep state people, others that were roadblocks, and literally not blacksiding them, but blacklisting them completely. And so a lot of those guys that decided that the kinetic side was where they needed to be going, started going, and they're known more as the Red Hats. And the White Hats and the Red Hats kind of have the same agenda, but two different ways of getting there, if that makes sense. But the thing about it was is that although JFK had his heart in the right place, trying to bring the Republic back from within, he didn't realize the depth and the breadth of the opposition, that how much that they actually had control of. And now we identify them as the cabal, the deep state, black hats, you know, whatever name you want to put on them. But how much they actually had at that particular time. And now that was in 63. Think about how much more control they have now. And it's international. It's not just the United States. It's international. But this council was not going to make the same mistakes again. Right? They fell back, as we do in the military, when we have come up against an opposition that we are having trouble advancing on. You take a strategic retreat or a strategic fallback. You regroup, you restrength, you re-strategize before you move forward again. You don't give up ground, but you don't continue to try to take any ground, because then you are just putting yourself out there to be slaughtered. And this is the point when previous President James Timothy Turner came into play in 2010. And I will leave it there, and we can pick up the rest of it next week. I was really hoping to get through all of this week, but we kind of go into the recent past and the future, I guess, next Sunday. And then we should be able to kind of get into hopefully some more Q&A and cross-referencing with everybody on a lot more as we go through. And so at this point right now, I'll open it up to any questions before we close out for tonight. The floor is open.
Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, this is Representative David Schmidt.
If I could.
Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you. I just wanted to point out that not only did George H.W. Bush get a reward of being the director of the CIA, but later on he also got a reward as being the vice president to run with Ronald Reagan. And Reagan really didn't want him for the vice president, but he thought he could do good for the country nonetheless. And so there's that. And also, I wanted to I also wanted to point out that September 10th of 2001, Rumsfeld announced there was $2.3 trillion that they could not account for. And you know what happened on September 11th of 2001, so they're covering their tracks there, I do believe. So that's all I had. Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Just to expand on that, all of the records apparently for that trillions of dollars was either in building 5 or building 7. I can't remember exactly which. I'll have to go back and look for sure. But it was in one of those two buildings. All the evidence of where that had disappeared to was in one of those buildings. And coincidentally, you had a fuselage and part of the plane that had gone through the building that landed on that building and ended up destroying that building. So all the evidence was destroyed as well with insiders. So that was really convenient that he comes out and says, hey, we're missing all this money, but, you know, we're investigating it and everything. All the information is, you know, we have it. We're going through it to try to figure it out, and it happened to be in one of those buildings. That's a very interesting spin of events.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Representative Schmidt, requesting the floor, please.
Go ahead,
sir.
Actually, the real location of all those documents was in the Pentagon section that was supposedly hit by the plane. That's where all the documentation on the $2.3 trillion was.
Was it?
I've seen that quite a bit. Yeah, it was in the Pentagon. And another thing also, as you also should be noted, is that the USA Patriot Act was in a finished form and ready to vote on in the House of Representatives. And what better way to eliminate opposition to the passage of it than to have a terrorist attack? And then we move up to about 6 weeks before the 2003 invasion of Iraq, they put out announced the reconstruction contracts for rebuilding Iraq. $7 billion was to go to Halliburton. And CEO of Halliburton between 1992 and 2000 was none other than Dick Cheney. In addition to that, the Halliburton stock had 6 months before then had plummeted down to $18 a share. And Bush Jr.'s uncle, William Henry Trotter Bush, happened to own 4.5 million shares of Halliburton stock. And within 6 months, the stock price was over $80. Now, just a few things there. I just thought I'd put that in here for you. And I think I'd seen a documentary. I'm going to go back to the Bobby Kennedy assassination for 2 minutes here. But anyway, I've seen one documentary on that. And Sirhan's gun, I think, held 8 rounds. And the police sat there and deemed that there actually recovered 10 rounds. So somebody else did some firing shot, and the medical examiner determined that the fatal shot was at point blank to his head. However, eyewitnesses stated that Sirhan never got any closer than 4 feet to Bobby Kennedy. I decided to put some of that in there for everybody, and with that, I yield the floor.
The possibility of one of his own Secret Service or somebody else that's, you know, pretty close to him to be able to get that close. That's interesting. The other piece that was interesting that you were talking about with Halliburton, how in the world did Halliburton end up having contracts and beat the initial forces, the initial U.S. military? How in the world did Halliburton beat us to Kuwait, Turkey, and in Iraq before we even got there?
Very simple.
If they didn't know what was going on before him.
And, well, another thing, I'll add one more quick thing here. Between 1992 and 2000, Halliburton got over $70 billion worth of contracts during that eight-year period. And, well, one of the things that there are, they started, I think, I can't remember what it was, under Bill Clinton or somewhere, either Bush Sr. or whatever that there are, they began... military began privatizing some of the services, you know, the basic services like to the military. And I'll just leave, you know, fill that in and yield the floor.
Mess halls, laundry. Yep. Mess halls, laundry, even some mechanic situations. Some of the administrative pieces, even some of the medical pieces. And then the kicker was replacing a lot of the MPs with civilian police on bases. Now, the interesting thing was is KBR, which is a part of power, has operated in numerous different theaters that part of the
Oh, you're breaking up.
Wait.
Hey, Daniel, you're breaking up pretty bad. You kind of sound like a robot. Hey, Daniel, it's not getting any better.
Sounds like somebody doesn't want him to speak.
Something like that, yeah. Well, maybe this would be a good time to break off and then come back next Sunday. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. A real quick prayer. Heavenly Father, please watch over us, guide us, direct us, lead us, and do your will to the glory of your holy name. Put domes of protection on us, our family, our friends, the enemy cannot penetrate through. Watch over us, Father. Bring your glory and your presence in our lives until we return again next week. We pray all this in the mighty name of Yeshua, according to your will, your word, and your plan. Thank you, Father. Amen and amen.
Amen.
Good night, everybody. God bless.
Yep, good night, everybody.
Have a good night. God bless.